The past is present in North Korea today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's threats to bomb North Korea, they sound new to us, but in Pyongyang...
From a North Korean perspective, successive American presidents have threatened bombing campaigns against North Korea. Trump is only the most recent.
Also, the story of the ruthless American spy who helped shape the Korean War.
He threw people out of airplanes, pushed them out of boats. He had a shootout with some of his own intelligence people who were reluctant to go to North Korea because they kept dying.
Plus, just how advanced is the scanning tech keeping our seaports safe?
You can actually tell the difference between a Coke and a Diet Coke in the box, and you can also detect exactly where that is in the container.
That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. We aim to help you understand what's happening around the globe, not to make you panic about it. I say that, but it's challenging when you need to talk about a hypothetical war with North Korea. There are the threats from North Korea and its refusal to give up its nuclear weapons program, and President Trump's own heated rhetoric aimed back at Kim Jong-un. So let's start the show today with a look back at a time when our country really was at war with North Korea. Some people here call the Korean War the Forgotten War, wedged as it was between World War II and Vietnam. Not the case in North Korea, where the government works hard to keep memories of the conflict alive. The Korean War actually marked the first chapter in the Cold War, but it was a shooting war, and a lot was hot. It was as hot as you could get. Washington supported South Korea. The Soviets and Chinese backed the North. The conflict was brutal on both sides, even if the details have faded in our collective memory. And speaking of the Forgotten War, The World's Matthew Bell starts us off today with the story of one man, a forgotten figure who played an outsized role in that war.
It started before sunrise on Sunday, June 25th, 1950. With Soviet support, North Korea launched a surprise attack against Korean military forces in the south and their U.S. allies.
South Korean villages awoke to a world suddenly filled with noise and flame. The communists, made bold by months of small-scale raiding across the 38th parallel, had finally launched their undeclared all-out war of conquest.
General Douglas MacArthur would later tell Congress that there was no way to predict the North Korean attack ahead of time. But MacArthur might have seen it coming if only he'd read some of the intelligence reports from a young U.S. Air Force officer in Korea named Donald Nichols.
Nichols' hair had been on fire for a year.
Blaine Harden is the author of a new book about Nichols called King of Spies.
The intelligence sources that he had in North Korea had been telling him that the Russians had been shipping in planes, artillery, and lots of ammunition and guns. And he'd passed that information on up the chain of command to Douglas MacArthur's chief of intelligence, Charles Willoughby. And for his trouble, Charles Willoughby tried to have Nichols fired and throw it out of Korea.
Nichols wasn't fired, and his intelligence reports weren't ignored for long. In the first few weeks of fighting, the North Koreans pushed U.S. troops onto the far southeast corner of the peninsula. They formed a line of defense around the port of Busan and faced the real possibility of total defeat in Korea. But Hardin says that Nichols helped save the Americans from losing the war.
He had in his hip pocket a codebreak team led by a North Korean who had defected prior to the war and who, as he moved to the south, brought with him North Korean Army battle codes.
Hardin writes about how Nichols and his team used those codes to relay North Korean movements in real time to the U.S. 8th Army, which was vastly outnumbered.
Whenever the North Koreans were going to make an incursion on the perimeter to try to really kill off the Americans, the 8th Army could prepare, and they rebuffed these incursions until the Americans could bring enough forces into the theater of that war. But for those few weeks, Nichols and the intelligence he was delivering were absolutely crucial to the war effort.
Dropping down to closer range, the B-26s come in to strafe enemy targets with rockets and machine guns.
Elsewhere, the conflict goes on without let-up. B-29 squadron based in Japan and on Okinawa continue their daily blasting of red industrial and transport centers in the north.
The old newsreels mention the American bombing campaign against North Korea, but they don't begin to describe the extent of the death and destruction brought down on the North by the U.S. Air Force. And in large part, it was made possible by Donald Nichols and his network of spies.
In a few weeks, Americans brought in large numbers of big bombers that had been used in World War II. They had lots of conventional bombs, and they had lots of napalm. And they just went to work, systematically destroying the cities of North Korea.
The bombing went on for 3 years. Hardin says about 85% of the buildings in North Korea were destroyed. Between 1 and 2 million civilians were killed. Throughout the war, Nichols ran a network of Korean agents who fed him information, like bombing targets, from inside North Korea. Hardin says Nichols learned the Korean language. He was shrewd, ruthless, and he had powerful friends in South Korea's military and government. Hardin says Nichols was like a real-life Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now.
Because as time went by during the war, he became increasingly free to do as he wished. So he was free to sort of go off the deep end in his behavior. But he was also delivering the goods. He ended up finding most of the targets for the carpet bombing of North Korea.
Did the North Koreans know who Donald Nichols was?
They did. They had radio broadcasts about him even before the war, and they tried to kill him. They sent assassins to his base. One was caught, shot, and buried not far from Nichols' headquarters.
Hardin says Nichols essentially had his own secret army and was allowed to operate virtually unchecked.
He threw people out of airplanes, pushed them out of boats. He had a shootout with some of his own intelligence people who were reluctant to go to North Korea because they kept dying. Nichols actually shot several of them in his own quarters. And this incident, this incredible shootout, never even made it into his military service record.
Hardin says Nichols was praised by his generals as an invaluable intelligence officer, as the best asset in the field, and a one-man war. But in the years after the Korean War, U.S. military and government officials decided that something needed to be done about Donald Nichols.
In the summer of 1957, U.S. Air Force MPs came for Nichols in the middle of the night and, according to an eyewitness, put him in a straitjacket. And according to his military records, the psychiatric notes of his treatment, he was given months of electroshock. And he told his family at the time that the U.S. Air Force was trying to destroy his memory. And they didn't destroy his memory because he ended up living for another 30 years, but they did destroy his credibility, and they erased him as an important actor in the war.
Officially, Hardin says, Nichols became a footnote in the U.S. military's telling of the Korean War, but he was much more than that, dark side and all. Hardin's book fills in a lot of gaps about this middle school dropout, who was later known to the North Koreans as the King of U.S. Spies. As one of Nichols' commanding officers said about him, this was someone you wanted on your side in wartime, and afterwards, you needed to put him in jail. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The Korean War was deadly for all sides. The numbers are just estimates, but as many as 500,000 dead in South Korea. The Chinese military lost almost as many, and almost 34,000 American troops were killed in action. David Kang is with the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. You've heard the expression, undoubtedly, some Americans use, the forgotten war. What do North Koreans call it? Because I bet they haven't forgotten.
They certainly haven't forgotten it, right? And one of the things that we have forgotten is that the U.S. Air Force carpet bombed North Korea to the point that they ran out of targets to bomb by late 1953. There was nothing left. They had destroyed almost everything they could.
You know, if you ask Americans, many people would say here that the Korean War ended in the 50s, though technically it did not. What about in North Korea? How do they date it?
They still view the possibility for an American attack that could come at any moment. So I don't think they ever view that the war has ended.
So that intensive bombing campaign that the U.S. conducted in North Korea, I mean, details about it have emerged in recent years. What do North Koreans grow up learning about that bombing campaign?
They grow up learning that this was a rain of fire and fury, as Trump has mentioned, but they've already lived through it once. There are memorials all over the place that show American bombers killing North Korean civilians. It's as formative an event in North Korea, understandably, as more so than, say, a 9/11 or a Pearl Harbor. To having endured the American bombing campaign is the signal way that they talk about the first Korean War.
And the phrase a lot of North Koreans use a lot, U.S. hostile policy. Is that phrasing from the Korean War, or do they look at U.S. policy today and say it's still hostile?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's much more of a recurring theme, is the hostility of the United States. In other words, from a North Korean perspective, successive American presidents have threatened bombing campaigns against North Korea. Trump is only the most recent. Bill Clinton made off-the-cuff comments about carpet bombing North Korea if they didn't behave. Bush and Obama have said all options are on the table. So from a North Korean perspective, the possibility that the United States out of the blue might start bombing them is a very real one.
Yeah, Donald Trump, though, he does go a step further. I think you'd agree, especially on Twitter. And it seems to kind of be shooting from the hip, especially lines like the North Koreans, quote, won't be around much longer. How is that perceived in the DPRK?
I actually think it's they underreact to Trump.
Really?
I would say that Americans are probably overreacting. He's flamboyant. But again, Trump isn't saying anything that previous presidents haven't said. He's just a little more flamboyant about it. And I think the North Koreans underreact because they have been preparing for another American bombing attack since the first one. They have been preparing and gaming out what they are going to do if the United States starts attacking them for 60 years. So in some ways, I don't think they view this as really any different.
So you would say that the North Koreans just see continuity from Bush to Obama to Trump?
Very much so. I don't think that they at all felt that before was less dangerous and now is more dangerous on a particularly noticeable scale.
Would you say the North Koreans are still essentially fighting the Korean War and that they're aiming to win it?
Oh, absolutely. For America, we have many things that occupy our minds, from the Middle East to Europe and Russia and everything else. North Korea has been focused on one thing, which is another war with the United States and how they're going to deal with it. And so they have been preparing for it and planning for it. It's one reason that there's so much digging going on in North Korea, and they've put everything underground. I mean, they all lived through the first bombing.
Explain what you mean by living underground.
One of the things that was noticed for decades is how much the North Koreans have dug in all of their military, most of their facilities, many of their missile sites and everything else are very deeply dug into ground. Their subway system in Pyongyang is one of the deepest in the world. It's like 100 meters down.
Wow.
They expect more American bombing.
That's incredible. So as to that first bombing during the Korean War in the 50s, there's been a debate that's never really been put to rest, and it's about how much this relentless U.S. bombing of North Korea is responsible for the way that North Korea acts today on the world stage, how they see the U.S. today. Where do you weigh in on this?
I weigh in that the Korean War was horrific on both sides. Millions of Koreans died, and that number is so big that it's hard to comprehend. So it left a scar on both North and South Korea. I think that both sides are doing their best to prepare for a second Korean War, but also I think are hoping that they can avoid it as well.
How worried are you by another Korean War right now?
I'm not very worried right now. I think that both sides are still fundamentally engaging in deterrence. As I said, no matter how flamboyant Trump is still fundamentally making deterrent claims, which is if you attack us first, we will wipe you off the face of the earth. And the North is saying the same thing as well. The costs are so high of starting a second Korean War, and thousands of American civilians and military will die if there's a second Korean War, that I think both sides are deterred from starting one.
David Kang, Korea expert at USC, thanks very much for the sober view. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Giving you a unique perspective on your world, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Big news from the Syrian city of Raqqa. ISIS is out. U.S.-backed Kurdish and Arab militias say they're now fully in control of the city after a bitter four-month battle to push out ISIS. Remember that ISIS claimed Raqqa as the capital of its so-called Islamic State Caliphate. The world's Rich Hall has been following events in Raqqa from his base in Beirut.
There was quite remarkable video online of the last ISIS fighters in the city boarding a bus. They stopped to take pictures one last time before they got on this bus and were evacuated out. So the Kurdish and Arab force claimed victory in the city. They say they've liberated most of it. There are a few holdouts elsewhere, but this is the day they're declaring liberation. There were big celebrations in the center of Raqqa, where ISIS used to carry out executions. So, yeah, a very symbolic defeat for ISIS and a big day in the fight against ISIS.
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty hard to reach residents of Raqqa during the fighting, but you did manage to speak to a native of Raqqa who's currently in Europe. How does he feel today now that the city is more or less ISIS-free?
That's right. I reached Mohammed Qadda in Germany. He left in 2015. He lived under ISIS for a while in Raqqa, but he was born there and grew up there. I wanted to kind of get a sense of how he felt about this liberation, and this is what he told me.
I don't believe that the city has been liberated today. It's just a new occupier take the city from another one. They killed thousands of civilians by artillery shells and by the coalition airstrikes. They destroy about 80% of the city. They want to capture the city no matter the cost.
Wow. I mean, the old occupier, though, ISIS, I mean, they ran roughshod over the city. They tortured people. I know Mohammed knows Raqqa well. He lived there for many years. Why is he angry that a U.S.-backed coalition of Kurdish and Arab militias have taken the city?
I should say that Mohammed is an anti-ISIS activist. He was actually working in Raqqa at great personal risk to get information out about ISIS crimes. So he has no love for ISIS whatsoever.
Yeah.
I asked him about this. I asked him this question that you asked me then. And he said, liberators don't destroy cities like this. He talked about the scale of destruction in Raqqa, which is just unimaginable. If you look at videos and pictures online, the city is virtually destroyed. It looks like one of those old World War II cities that are just completely flattened by airstrikes. This was one of the most intense areas for airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition. They essentially flattened the city to make way for fighters to go in. More than 1,000 civilians were killed in this fight. So as far as he's concerned, he's asking himself the question, why did they have to do this? Why did they have to destroy my city to liberate it? I should say as well also that many people inside Raqqa were very grateful to the fighters that liberated the city. Mohammed has one point of view, but there are many people who are very grateful for this liberation.
So someone like Mohammed, is he so opposed to Bashar al-Assad that he'd rather have ISIS in Raqqa if Assad isn't removed?
No, certainly not. People like Mohammed refuse the rule of Assad and ISIS. They want to decide who rules them.
So what is next for ISIS and for Raqqa, Rich?
We shouldn't kid ourselves that this is the end of ISIS. What will happen now, and what's already happening, is that ISIS is transitioning from a self-declared country back into a terrorist organization, an insurgency that carries out attacks abroad. But what we can say is that the loss of Raqqa and Mosul and these big population centers will certainly limit their ability to carry out these attacks. They made a lot of money from taxing the populations they ruled and from taking over factories and oil fields, and they're losing this source of income now. So a weakened organization for sure, but still a threat.
The World's Rich Hall following the situation in Raqqa and Syria from his base in Beirut. Good to speak with you again, Rich. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
You may recall that ISIS was threatening oil fields in northern Iraq and that the military force known as the Peshmerga came in to defend that land and a major city there called Kirkuk. The Peshmerga are Kurds from what's known as the autonomous region of Kurdistan. It's part of Iraq but separated by a lot of history. And just a few weeks ago, Kurds there voted for independence from Iraq. Let's circle back to those oil fields now and look at what happened just yesterday. Iraqi army soldiers took control of Kurdish-controlled Kirkuk and its oil. To spell out why that's important here in the U.S., we called on someone who knows a lot about Iraq and the oil there, Ben Van Heuvelen, your editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report. How big a deal is this?
It's a huge deal. The territorial boundaries between the Kurdistan region and the federal government have been redrawn. The control of northern Iraqi oil resources has shifted. It is a different Iraq today than it was 2 days ago.
Whose oil is this? I mean, does anybody have a legitimate claim to it?
The Iraqi constitution says that all of Iraq's oil belongs to the Iraqi people, but there's a good legal argument to support a very autonomous oil sector for the Kurds. There's a very good argument to support a centralized control of the oil sector for the federal government. And there's also a lot of ambiguity around who should control these disputed areas on the southern border of the Kurdistan regional government's territory.
So historically, the U.S. has been a friend of the Kurds. During Saddam Hussein's rule, people remember the U.S. protected them with a no-fly zone. But the U.S. supports the Iraqi government, too, and it's not really in a position to waver on that support. And U.S. troops are in the region now. Did any of your reporting reveal what the U.S. was doing yesterday? Like, did the U.S. take a side?
The U.S. has said officially that it hasn't taken sides, But they're saying that as the Iraqi government is driving tanks and troops right up to the border of Kurdish-controlled territory and then coming in and driving through. So I think that both sides in Iraq have interpreted the U.S. claim that it's not supporting anybody as tacit support for Baghdad.
So the people in Kirkuk obviously are Kurds. They're also ethnically Turkmen and Arabs there. The politics, I imagine, must be pretty complicated. After this military action, how will the Kurds sort all this out?
That really remains to be seen. Right now, Kurdish security forces have withdrawn entirely from Kirkuk City, which, as you said, is ethnically very mixed. We also know that before all of this happened, the PKK, which is a Kurdish guerrilla group that's designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, had set up a lot of cells within Kirkuk. So if there is not some sort of a political accommodation that gives Kurds at least some control over the security in the city and some political representation, it would not be at all unreasonable to expect violence to erupt.
Is it all about the oil in Iraqi Kurdistan, do you think, Ben?
Well, I think it's half about the oil.
What's the other half?
Kirkuk is incredibly significant in the Kurdish national narrative. This is a place where Saddam Hussein conducted a genocide against the Kurds to change the demographics of that city in that oil-rich area and get them out.
Gassed hundreds of thousands of them.
Yes. And so any attempt by Baghdad to push Kurds out of these disputed territories recalls those historical atrocities of Saddam Hussein. So in that sense, it has nothing to do with oil. However, it is also true that there are massive oil fields there. And as a result of these federal troop movements, the Kurdistan region has lost control of just about half of the oil production that it controlled a week ago. So that's devastating for the Kurdistan region's economy. It undermines its ability to function as an economically independent state.
Ben Van Heuvelen, editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report, explaining what's at stake in Kirkuk. Really appreciate your time, Ben. Thank you.
My pleasure.
The day's top news stories are coming up in 1 minute right here on The World. Hi, Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, we hear about security at the port of Boston and how finding a bomb in one box there could lead to economic chaos.
Wait, we've got to check all the other boxes so they don't pose a risk. And that process of trying to do that will cause a cascading, essentially, backups across the global system.
Balancing security and efficiency ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The images have been unreal. Wildfires racing through the countryside, homes burning quickly to the ground, thousands of people fleeing for their lives, and some of them don't make it. Northern California isn't the only place in the world that's been going through all that. So have parts of Portugal and Spain. Wildfires raging in both countries have claimed more than 30 lives. A buddy of mine, Rafa Cochera Campora, scouts music locations in rural Spain, and he found himself this weekend in the middle of a fire in Galicia. Sunday, very late, you wrote on Facebook, "Can't see, can't breathe, evacuated." Then sometime later, you wrote, "Fire doesn't sleep. After collapsing for 3 hours, we awake to a nightmare world of smoke and ash everywhere. Speechless." So I got to say, myself and your friends following you on Facebook were worried. It sounds like you had some close calls.
Well, yeah. Essentially what happened was after, like I said, we spotted this smoke in the distance, in the horizon, that just quickly began to grow. The winds were really wicked that day, so essentially all of the ingredients you need for massive wildfires were in place. From the point that we saw that smoke, it just started tunneling down in all directions. When I wrote the can't see, can't breathe, evacuated, was to the point when all of a sudden the smoke was so dense that we literally couldn't breathe anymore. So we decided to go down to the town. But then we were in town for about 10 minutes, and my friend who has the bodega said, "Look, man, I can't be here." So we actually went to the face of the fire and tried to help the local forces put it out. But I need to say the local forces was just us and volunteers and local neighbors, all with sticks and buckets. And there was a total lack of organization. At this point, people were in panic. And the fire was at the point where it was at the foot of the villages. And so everyone was just doing what they could to stop the fire from actually getting into the towns and burning down houses.
What did it look like today driving through this aftermath?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really not sure what kind of words I can put to what you feel. I mean, you know, what you see is just charred earth in all directions. You know, of course, there's lots of places that weren't burnt, luckily. So you have this contrast between this kind of beautiful autumn leaves changing and green pastures surrounded by these massive parcels of thousands of hectares of land that is just black, charred earth. And so it's just this kind of strange parallel world of beautiful autumn and just total black destruction.
Rafa Cochera Campora describing the impact of the fires on northwestern Spain. Reporter Paul Ames is in Lisbon, Portugal. He told me about the environmental factors fueling the fires in Portugal, and they'll sound familiar to anyone following the fires in Northern California.
We've had a very bad drought, very high temperatures, and then, of course, we've had strong winds pushed around by these Atlantic storms, which have been hitting Ireland and the United Kingdom, and it's whipped up a kind of perfect storm, really, in terms of heat and wind, and it's just produced these devastating fires.
Portugal accounts for 40% of the wildfires in Europe, I've read. I mean, does that suggest that this is not unusual, or it's just worse than you've ever seen in Portugal?
Yeah, it's been very bad. And of course, those figures that you've mentioned are bringing up lots of questions now being asked about Portugal's ability to cope with these fires. People are asking why this happened. Twice this year, we've had dozens of people killed. And there are questions about how this is being managed by the emergency forces and by the government. The opposition parties have even called for a motion of censure in the parliament over the way the government has handled this.
I mean, forest management, it's hard to control drought and wind, but you can control the forest. How has that been going for the government?
Yeah, forest management is a major problem here. Portugal is a major paper producer, and much of the country has been planted with fast-growing eucalyptus and pine trees, which feed into the paper industry. Some of that is in well-managed forests, but a lot of it is done privately. People just plant these things on scraps of land, and they don't look after the forest. So without a kind of coordinated attempt to clear away the undergrowth and prevent this buildup of highly flammable material, that's what a lot of people are pointing to as the root cause of these disasters.
I hear eucalyptus is also can be a flammable tree. Is that correct?
Eucalyptus is a very flammable tree. It's very fast growing, so the paper industry likes it, but it has this bark which flakes off. And if the forest is not well managed, there's this kind of accumulation of this dry strips of bark which build up beneath the trees. And that's a very, very flammable mix. Also, pine trees. One of the forests which was very badly burnt is a very ancient pine forest that was planted in the 13th century, and which provided wood for the Portuguese ships that went off on voyages of discoveries. About 80% of that forest is now burnt. That's a pine forest near the city of Leiria.
So, Paul, what's the prognosis going forward, like just the next day or two?
Well, fortunately, we finally had some rain. As I mentioned earlier, Portugal has been suffering a very bad drought this year, but we had a major downpour last night, which has basically put out most of the fire. So the firefighters are able to relax a little bit today. Hopefully more rain is forecast for the next few days. So people are keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that there won't be a repeat of this now.
That was reporter Paul Ames speaking with us from Lisbon, Portugal. Let's turn to Somalia now for an update on this weekend's news there. More than 280 people were killed when a massive truck bomb exploded in the capital, Mogadishu. Hundreds more people wounded. Today, emergency workers continued to dig through the rubble looking for bodies and any survivors. Terrible news, but here is one upside. Volunteers have been coming together to help families connect online with missing loved ones and to coordinate other relief efforts. Khalid Abdul Harid is one of those volunteers. He lives in another city in Somalia, but happened to be in Mogadishu on the day of the attack.
I came here for the Mogadishu book fair, and this happened, so I wanted to take part of it.
Khalid and dozens of other volunteers have been gathering at a center in Mogadishu, working around the clock since Saturday's explosion.
The volunteers here, they have a lot of different backgrounds, health, doctors, medical doctors. We have specialties here. We also have data analysts. We have journalists that are working on it, tweeting and everything on websites, writing, capturing everything. The thing that we wanted to have an impact on is finding the people that are missing. We have hotline centers where people call, families call and ask for that person. The hotline registers people. They register who calls and they register who they're looking for. And then we just post it on social media. Our community uses Facebook the most, so we post on Facebook.
Thousands of Somalis have been following the online channels on Twitter, Facebook, and a website to find out about missing relatives. Khalid says they've been able to reconnect several families. The volunteers are also using their newly created network to coordinate other efforts, including blood donations, and to get the word out about new information from the government. They're calling the effort GURMUD 252.
GURMUD means a lot of people join their efforts to a certain emergency.
So support, really.
Support, really, yeah.
That support is also coming from Somalis outside of the country, like a Somali-Swedish man who used a crowdfunding website to raise money to get ambulances for those in need. Khalid says in the past he and other Somalis have started other tech-based initiatives to respond to emergencies, including coordinating efforts to help those affected by the drought that hit the country earlier this year.
We have been doing this tech thing for quite some long right now. When the drought hit Somalia, we started a couple of initiatives that were doing the same thing that we're doing right now, basically.
Khalid says there's a void that young techies in Somalia can fill to create a better-connected emergency response center.
We're trying to implement a routine coordination center that works like us. We're trying to keep the office going on.
Khalid Abdul Harid, a volunteer who's trying to help the many people affected by this weekend's deadly truck explosion in Mogadishu. Another story now from our 50 States project. We're looking at how globalization is affecting communities all over the U.S. And today we head just down the road from our Boston studios. The World's Jason Margolis visited the Port of Boston to find out how ports are balancing a huge surge in shipping traffic with the need for better security.
Modern shipping containers are a bit like Legos. You can take them off a ship and snap them perfectly onto a truck or train. This relatively simple innovation has allowed global trade to go gangbusters.
It was in 1992 when 100 million containers moved through all the world's ports. And then in 1998, we went to 200 million.
That's Stephen Flynn, founding director of the Global Resilience Institute at Northeastern University in Boston. He says now today, roughly 600 million containers are shipped around the world.
So just between the events of 9/11 and the events of today, you almost have a threefold of volume moving through the world's ports.
The Port of Boston has seen record volumes year after year. It's New England's busiest container port, still tiny compared with the major U.S. ports like Long Beach in California, New Orleans, or New York and New Jersey. Port of Boston director Lisa Whelan says the ships they're seeing these days, they're massive.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the ships that come here now, frankly, our cranes can barely work those ships.
And the ships being built are only getting bigger. Much bigger.
And what that means is ports like the Port of Boston, as well as ports across the East Coast, are having to invest to dredge their harbors and put in new, larger cranes and deeper berths to handle these vessels and all the cargo that's coming with them.
The port is taking on a $350 million expansion with some funding help from Washington. Rockford White says it's a wise investment. He directs the Maritime Studies program at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. White says container shipping has become so efficient, it's often cheaper to move items halfway across the world by ship than 50 miles by truck.
50 miles. So it's cheaper in Boston to send the container from China through either the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal, occasionally around the Cape of Good Hope. They come to Boston in any scenario, that is cheaper than then shipping it to Vermont from Boston by truck.
Shipping containers are part of the reason we can get flat-screen TVs for a few hundred bucks. Again, yes, there are downsides to globalization, wiping out lots of local manufacturing across America. Stephen Flynn at Northeastern says our modern shipping was developed with two goals, to be cheap and efficient. He says the challenge now is to make it more secure.
The amount of materials that are out there and dangerous actors who want access to these materials has only grown.
Back at the Port of Boston, about 600 trucks pass in and out each day. Sean Fales is a U.S. Customs and Border Protection watch commander. We stand next to an exit lane as trucks prepare to pass between two poles.
And as you see this truck coming at us, he'll slow down about 5 miles an hour, and we'll do a full scan of his truck.
In the span of about a minute, three trucks are scanned for radioactive material.
That's about as fast as the exam is. So as you can see, it really does keep the flow going.
This protocol is standard at all U.S. maritime ports. If radiation were to be detected, the container would undergo further testing before it could leave the port. Trucks can also be X-rayed, kind of like a huge piece of luggage at an airport. And Port Director Lisa Whelan says tomorrow's scanning technologies are only getting better.
You can actually tell the difference between a Coke and a Diet Coke in the box, and you can also detect exactly where that is in the container.
It's not reading the label. It can differentiate between sugar and artificial sweetener. That technology is still being tested. Rockford Weitz says port security has come a long way since 9/11.
I think Congress needs people to praise it more. They're not asleep at the switch on this one. You know, they're asleep on the switch on many issues. But on port security, they have tried.
Still, White says we could go much further to increase our safety. The major threat isn't a dirty bomb passing through a port like Boston. The fear is that it could go off at a port. This could put port employees and people nearby at risk. Stephen Flynn warns that this type of event could disrupt our entire way of life.
Because what will happen is not just a local incident. The response to the incident will almost certainly be, wait, we've got to check all the other boxes so they don't pose a risk. And that process of trying to do that post an event will cause a cascading, essentially, backups across the global system that would take weeks to sort out. So it's a case of not that mass loss of life. It's not a case of mass destruction. It's really a story of mass disruption.
Flynn has testified before Congress 33 times about maritime safety. He says we need to know what's in our containers before they arrive at our ports. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security does have a lot of that information, but Flynn argues there are still too many points of vulnerability in the system overseas. He says the world's largest shipping companies based in Asia and Europe need to work more with governments and ports. And by Flynn's estimation, for $10 or $15 a container, we could all be much safer. As ports like Boston continue to expand, Flynn says that's, quote, an incredibly cheap investment in security and something we need to do. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boston.
For more of our 50 states coverage on the impact of globalization on communities across America, just go to PRI.org. President Trump got a lot of criticism, including from U.S. allies, for his decision last week not to certify the Iran nuclear deal. Trump, though, seemed nonplussed at a cabinet meeting yesterday.
I'm tired of being taken advantage of as a nation. This nation has been taken advantage of for many, many years, for many decades, frankly.
Iran has rejected Trump's assertion that they're not living up to the spirit of the nuclear agreement. And Iran's deputy foreign minister went further in an interview with our colleagues at the BBC. Sayed Mohammad Kazem Sajapour said President Trump's action was motivated by domestic U.S. politics.
I think it's too early to suggest what will happen on the American side, because what we see on the American side is a chaotic situation in the decision-making, in the way that it's approached. And I think this chaotic situation is contrasted by the clarity of international community, the consensus by Europeans and the global community that it is a deal which Iran is observing, is abiding by the confirmation of the 7 consecutive reports by International Atomic Agency.
Last week, Trump also announced new U.S. sanctions against Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which he accused of supporting terrorism. Sajapour rejected that as well.
The Revolutionary Guard is part of our political system and political architecture and security architecture in the Constitution. So we will take proper action, and we cannot really ignore anything which negates our security, and it would be, I think, a lawful action if such a position is taken, and we would respond accordingly.
Iran's deputy foreign minister there speaking with our London colleagues at the BBC. The story is far from over, of course. Keep listening to The World for the latest developments on the Iran deal. Last week, I was telling you about my upcoming conversation with South African musician Johnny Clegg. Born in England, raised in South Africa, the heart of apartheid, became deeply curious about Zulu culture, especially street guitar styles and Zulu warrior dances.
Zulu war dancing, you're living inside the daily local level politics of tribesmen.
Our conversation happened on Sunday, and he told me, as an outsider and as a secular white Jewish boy, Clegg kind of flew under the apartheid radar. He felt free to follow his curiosity, a privilege that a black boy his age surely would not have been able to do. Clegg, on the other hand, when he wanted to learn more about Zulu dance, he thought nothing of walking right into a place he wasn't supposed to be in, one of the many migrant worker hostels near Johannesburg.
It's only for men, no women, no other race groups allowed in. It's run by the municipal police. It's 2,000 men in a hostel. They're all fighting for beds. It's like a military barracks. It's open plan beds, 20 beds in a room, open plan kitchen, open plan showers.
So into this world stepped Johnny Clegg, vouched for by his Zulu friend and fellow musician, Sipho Mchune.
You know, I lived in that thing, you know, as a young 15-year-old, 16-year-old.
That's what's always kind of amazed me. In apartheid South Africa, how you were accepted into this world.
Yeah.
It's baffling.
Well,
do you find it baffling still?
My passport was that I was a kid. And I was not yet, in a way, part of the oppressive apparatus. I wasn't an adult. I wasn't going into the army. I was 15. And I had a genuine love and a genuine hunger for this, and they recognized that.
Those early trips to the hostels, learning Zulu warrior dances and singing with these hundreds of men, those experiences had a visceral grip on Johnny Clegg that would never let go.
We were all bare-chested. We had Zulu car ties, dancing sandals, and black pants, and we'd sit there, and there was the absolutely overpowering, overwhelming smell of male sweat, some of it from a few days ago, and on a very, 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 very strong in this room, mixed in with the most amazing male vocal singing.
Now, the South African police, who regularly conducted raids on the Zulu worker hostels, didn't get Johnny Clegg's fascination. And one time when they found this 15-year-old white kid amongst the black migrants, the cops couldn't believe his story.
And so when the police came on a raid and they saw me in the middle, they thought I'd be kidnapped. And they said to me, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." And they said, "What are you doing?" I said, I'm dancing." And they said, "It's okay, you don't have to say that. You're safe now." I said, no, I'm learning how to dance." And then they got upset. And they took me out and they put me in the car and they took me to my mom.
His mom was upset, but Johnny was not deterred. He got the 69-year-old leader of the dance troupe he was learning from to come to talk to his mother.
His name was Richard Zwane, and I was very short for my age. You know, when I was 16, I looked 12, but he looked even shorter than me. And he sat there like this little gnome, and my mom interviewed him. And she slowly got more comfortable, and he said, "You know, you must understand, when we sing him into the hostel, he's our boy. And you must understand, we are the only dance team in the world that has a white boy who's dancing with them. And we're training him up, and, you know, we're going to win every competition." And, you know, it's like a, you know. So she felt comforted by that. And then she just said, "Look, you know, look after yourself."
These days, Johnny Clegg is looking after himself on a whole other level. Clegg was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 2 years ago. He went through chemo. The tumor cell count dropped. Another round of chemo, and the cancer went in remission. But the doctors told him that because pancreatic cancer is so aggressive, he should take his final tour now. Johnny Clegg has more dates across North America this week and next. His energy still lets him do those Zulu warrior kicks where your foot shoots up to your armpit. And his doctor says his positivity has been a crucial factor in how his cancer has progressed.
The doctor said to me, the oncologist, he said, you know, we do know scientifically that 20% of what you do in your daily life helps your condition. So for me, it's really just been listening to that thing. He said, you know, you're doing something right in your daily life. You keep away from stress. Apparently was good. It's good not to be too stressed out.
You can find the rest of Johnny Clegg's Final Journey concert schedule on his Facebook page. You really don't want to miss this last tour. In Boston, I'm Marco Werman at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble. Trouble, trouble. I'm, oh, I'm, oh.
PRI, Public Radio International.